We're pleased to have the men and representatives of the woman who want to be your next senator, serving alongside Senator Paul Wellstone in the U.S. Senate. Today's discussion is the first of a series of public policy forums on political candidates, and we're pleased to have six of the seven major candidates who are vying for the DFL endorsement for the U.S. Senate seat. I'm going to read their names, and what we're going to do today is have them each begin by making a five-minute opening statement indicating why they want to serve you, why they want you to vote for them. And after the first statements, we've got a panel here, two people representing Insight News and one representing the Coalition of Black Churches. For Insight News, Roy Bell, and also for Insight News, Loy Namard, who's our reporter, and Reverend Randy Staden, who is the chairperson and leader of the Black Church Coalition, serving as a panel to ask questions of the candidates. We also have an open microphone, and people here in the audience can raise questions of the candidates. After the first five-minute presentation, we will ask the candidates to respond to questions from our reporting panel, and if people in the audience have questions they want to raise, they can raise those. We'll ask candidates to leave those responses, to keep those responses down to 1 minute, 1 minute and a half. I've asked Mr. Jamal Muhammad to hold up a card here in the audience, so for the first five-minute presentation, when you're 4 minutes in and have 1 minute to go, it's upside down. You'll be told you've got 1 minute to go, and then you'll be told 30 seconds to go. We'll ask you to respect the timekeeping and keep your comments within those times. Let me begin by introducing the entire panel, and then I'll start with the first who will make the presentation to you. The panel includes, on my far left here, Mr. Steve Miles. Next to him, and the second person you'll hear, is Steve Kelly. Next to Steve Kelly, you'll hear, after him, David Lillehog, then Mark Dayton, next, Jerry Jancich, and finally, Mike Cerisi. And I'll ask each candidate, I'm asking you now then, when you introduce yourself, give your background briefly and tell why you want Minnesota to send you to Washington representing our state. Let me then begin with Steve Miles. Good morning, Steve Miles. Slide the microphone down and welcome.
Good morning, and it's a pleasure to be at Lucille's Kitchen again, and although this is the first time I've been on this side of the table, so I'm delighted to be here. I'm a physician in geriatric medicine with a long career in public and teaching hospitals. A long time in particular at Hennepin County Medical Center where I trained. I served with Minnesotans for Affordable Health Care as its president the year we brought in MinnesotaCare, and was also with President Clinton's Health Care Reform Task Force. And the core of my campaign is that everybody must have continuous, affordable health care, access to health care that is not connected to work, that is comprehensive, and that can never be taken away from them from a provider of their choice. Secondly, we need to have in this system a decent schools. Our K through 12 system is seriously underfunded. The federal government has been walking away from it. Special education is in disarray, and I say this as a foster parent of a child who we adopted who has fetal alcohol syndrome, who we were able to purchase services for, which are simply not available. And as a result, she's in college, now heading to being a success as a preschool teacher, but other children don't have that. We must, in addition, with regard to education, keep the school door open throughout the entire working life. People should not be made obsolete by new technologies, and people who pursue various types of life careers, including early families, should not find that that choice leaves them unable to get higher education later in life. Finally, the proposal to privatize Social Security is a stupid idea. Graham supports it. I don't. Now, I've lived in Minneapolis for virtually my entire adult life. I still live in Minneapolis. Been an active participant in many of the community groups in town. I'm a PAGE mentor, and I'm proud to say that my the student that I am supervising under the PAGE Foundation program, She came to me intending to be a lab technician, and now she's applying to go to medical school. That's the type of support we need to help children grow up to achieve their full potential, and I congratulate the Page family for making that possible. I'm also a member of ACORN and MICA, and have been with the Council on Black Churches as they have pursued correctly the aggressive program to prevent the destruction of housing in this city and to assure that affordable housing is available. I've worked in many of the community clinics, many of the battered women's shelters, and I aggressively believe that we need most urgently in the Twin Cities area to address the problems of economic justice, which have left us the most racially segregated by wealth metro area in the United States. And I look forward to discussing these issues in more detail with you today.
Thank you very much. That was Steve Miles. Next, we're going to hear from Steve Kelly. Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. I appreciate the efforts of KMOJ and the African-American leaders to organize this event to provide an opportunity for a dialogue on issues important to the African-American community and to all of Minnesotans. I'm Steve Kelly. I'm a state senator. I represent Hopkins and St. Louis Park. I grew up just outside Hopkins, and after law school moved back to Minneapolis to St. Louis Park and got involved in the DFL in 1980 for the first time. And also at that time, I began my public life in a different way by joining the board of a battered women's shelter. A friend of my family, I think, was looking for a cheap lawyer who was willing to offer services free to the newly formed Sojourner Shelter for Battered Women, named after Sojourner Truth. And I served on the board for 9 years and was 3 years the chair of the board, and remember vividly arguing for the location of our shelter in Minnetonka in the face of objections from a community that I now represent that they didn't want people not like them walking on their streets, coming into their neighborhood, and by that they meant folks from Minneapolis, often folks who were of color, that they didn't want to see in the neighborhood. I knew then, I know today, that we have to stand up against that kind of exclusion from our communities and from services to people who need them. I got elected to the House of Representatives of Minnesota in 1992 and then to the Senate in 1996, and I've worked on education, particularly on making sure that everyone in Minnesota, wherever they live, whether it's neighborhoods in Minneapolis or on a farm or community in rural Minnesota, has access to the tools to succeed in this new economy. And I want to be the next U.S. Senator because I think that this growing global economy still presents enormous opportunity for all Minnesotans, all Americans, to do better for themselves and their families. But we aren't doing enough as a nation to make sure that everyone is participating in that. There are too many people in Minnesota, 25% of Minnesotans, who make $8 an hour or less. 40% make $10 an hour or less. That is not enough. We need a federal government policy that is designed to make sure that people have the tools to develop their skills and opportunity through education and lifelong learning to do better. Job training ought not wait until you lose a job. We also have a situation going on in welfare reform where we are succeeding in placing welfare recipients in jobs, moving from welfare to work, but then we leave too many recipients in those positions at inadequate rates of pay to support a family. We need a policy change that makes sure that we do not forget about folks once they get a job, that we give them the opportunity and the support for training that will raise their skill level, raise their earning level, and move those families to a position where they can earn a living wage. This is about not making more jobs in this country, but making sure we make better jobs for people and enable people to have the skills to fill those jobs. We also need a health care system that provides access to health care regardless of your income. It ought not be an issue that you cannot afford to pay for health care, because we have to give every child, every adult in this country the opportunity to do better, and they can't do it if they're worried about being sick.
Thank you, Steve Kelly. Oh. I want to ask Mr. Muhammad, when you hold the sign up, hold it up so that all the candidates can see it, because he probably couldn't see the signs, but wave it out so they can see it clearly, okay? Next, we're going to hear from candidate David Lillehog. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to everybody. I'm running for the United States Senate because I think we can do a heck of a lot better than Rod Grams, but I think Rod Grams is just a symptom of a deeper problem, and that's a lack of respect for people and families and neighborhoods in this global economy. And I'm running because I respect people and family and neighborhoods. I'm a grassroots neighborhood kind of person, and that's the kind of United States Senator that I would be. During my professional life, I've been grappling with issues of equal justice under the law and equal protection of the law. And I had a chance to do that firsthand when I was United States Attorney for Minnesota for 4.5 years. And whenever I walk onto this block, I always remember Gary Suddeth. And I miss Gary Suddeth. The first week I was U.S. Attorney, I called him and reached out to him, but more importantly, he reached out to me. And he did that during my 4.5 years as United States Attorney. When I was U.S. Attorney, Minneapolis was faced with an extraordinary issue, a rising crime rate, including a murder rate, and a great percentage of the victims were young African American men. And I decided federal law enforcement had to do something different. Now, ordinarily, the United States Attorney sits in this beautiful corner office in the federal courthouse and waits for the cases to come to the federal government. And I decided that was not adequate. And so I started getting involved at the grassroots level in the Phillips, Central, Powderhorn neighborhoods, Hawthorne, Near North, Harrison, and over in St. Paul and Thomasdale and Frogtown, connecting with neighborhood associations and block clubs and teachers and social workers and cops on the beat. Because the issue of crime is not just one of public safety. It is not just one of law enforcement. It's a matter of reaching out to people and connecting and preventing and reducing crime before it starts. And of course, there are many issues of race implicated in law enforcement. And that was driven home to me one day in my first year as United States Attorney. I was down at Four Winds Elementary School near the corner of Chicago and Franklin. I was talking to the principal. And she mentioned that the kids at Four Winds Elementary, mainly children of color, had that morning had a bullet drill on their playground. And I said, what's a bullet drill? And she said, well, there are so many shots coming from that park over there that we have to teach our children that when they hear a bang, they must drop to the dirt immediately. Don't stop and ask, is that from a gun or is it from something else? And it struck me in the gut. Can you imagine if a child in Woodbury or Edina or Apple Valley came home and said, hey, Mom, hey, Dad, I had a bullet drill today at school. What do you think would happen in the state? Everyone from the governor on down would be mobilized. We will not rest until this problem of the bullets in Edina and Woodbury and Apple Valley is solved. And my question is, don't the children of Phillips and Central and Powderhorn and Near North and Harrison deserve the same treatment, the same respect, the same dignity? Equal justice under the law, equal protection of the law. We do not have that equal justice in Washington today. Rod Grams is a symptom of a deeper problem, and that is if you've got money or you've got power, you will be listened to in Washington. If you do not, you will not be heard. Look who makes the campaign contributions in this country. Only 20% of Americans ever make a campaign contribution. For most people, it's an unnatural act, and who can blame them? 95% of those who do are white, 95% are straight, 80% are men, 85% make over $100,000 a year, 85% of them have some kind of interest in the federal government. It is the old, rich, straight, white males who are being heard in Washington. And it may have escaped your attention, I'm a white guy.
But let me tell you, there need to be more straight white males standing up for equal justice and equal protection in this country. And that means living wage, patient-friendly, affordable health care, public education. It means transit. It means extending Medicare to prescription medication. It means public safety. It means the things that mean respect for people and families and neighborhoods in the global economy. And I look forward to discussing those specific issues with you today. Thank you.
Thank you, David Littlehug. Next, we'll hear from Mark Dayton. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Al. Thank you for having us here today, Lucy, KMOJ. I'm Mark Dayton, and I'm also a candidate for the United States Senate. And this is a job interview, well-designed, because you and your fellow citizens in Minnesota are hiring a public servant to go to Washington and work for you. And these forums over the next 4 months throughout our state will be the job interviews and evaluations that should decide the outcome of our primary and the general election then following 8 weeks later. And having participated in two of these candidate forums when I ran for governor in 98, I want to forewarn my friends up here, this is a tough group of graders. If all of you were designing the basic skills test for our nation's politicians, the failure rate would be a national crisis, and it would deserve to be. I'm running because I think this is perhaps the last good opportunity in America to save this country. Because when historians look back on this era, they'll be less impressed with the gains in the stock markets and this so-called prosperity as defined at a macro level, which when you break it down is the super rich getting super richer and most of America being left behind and the poor getting poorer and that gap widening, and they'll be shocked and they'll be horrified and they'll be appalled and they'll say, how can a nation which prides itself on its values and on morality and on a variety of religious ethics have turned its back while that happened? And how could it be that in this era of budget surpluses in St. Paul and Washington, nothing is being done? In fact, matters are getting worse. And I'll remind you that nobody up here is the government. And I'm tired, frankly, across this country of having the Republicans and those who are responsible for making government worse, for defunding programs to help people, for putting government, as David said, well, further on the side of the wealthy, the powerful, and the special interests, then turn around and say, well, see, we're right. Government doesn't work for people. Well, yeah, it's darn right it doesn't work for people because they're the ones who are in charge of government. And that's the opportunity we have this year in Minnesota to take one step forward, to put one more U.S. senator from Minnesota on the side of the people. We got the best U.S. senator in Washington today, Paul Wellstone. We need someone who works with him rather than somebody who cancels him out on every important vote. I'm running with my credentials being that I've devoted my entire life to public service. I grew up, it's well known, in a wealthy Republican family. I was probably almost a teenager when I came home one day and asked my father, Dad, what's a Republican? He didn't know either, so we looked it up together in the dictionary. But all that changed for me in 1968. And it changed the night that I came home from college, the night after I came home from college, the end of my junior year, and watched on television as my political hero, Robert Kennedy, was murdered right before my eyes. And I remember my affinity with him was not only that he opposed the Vietnam War, which is important to me, but that he had went beyond that. And he was a public servant in the true sense, and he cared about people. And I remember the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated, that he went into Indianapolis. The police chief of Indianapolis wouldn't protect him, wouldn't go with him. He went in there against the advice because he believed that he belonged with the people. And he cared, and he wanted to make this a better country. He wanted to make this a country where everybody had full opportunity. I believe this should be a country where every child has the kind of opportunities that I had, the kind of education that I'm able to pay to give to my children. Why shouldn't every child in America have those opportunities? Why shouldn't everybody have health care? Why shouldn't everybody have a chance to earn a living wage to begin and then move beyond? It's those failures that I intend to address as a senator.
Thank you, Mark Dayton. Next, we'll hear from Jerry Janicich. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Jerry Janicich, and I'm a Democrat. And I'm proud of being a Democrat. I'm from northern Minnesota, Chisholm, born and raised there, went to Chisholm Public Schools, Hibbing Community College, and St. Cloud State. In 1972, I graduated from St. Cloud State with a degree in teaching. And for those of you here who graduated at that time with a degree in teaching, you know that the teaching profession was pretty full. But while I was going to school, I did odds and end jobs like most of us do. I laid sod, I put in septic systems, and I bartended. Of the three, bartending appealed to me the most. So at 22 years old, I bought my first small business with my partner. I bought a bar. 6 years later, we owned our second business. We owned a pizza place in the same community. In 1982, Rudy Perpich got elected governor. You helped do that. And we just heard about Rudy's appointment a little while ago. Well, I ran for the county board, and I won. 6 years later, I ran for the Minnesota House, and I won. 4 years later, I ran for the state senate, and I won. Today, I'm here to run for the U.S. Senate. And I don't need any polls. I went to Mrs. O's third grade class, and they were asked, if Jerry Janicich gets elected to the U.S. Senate, what do you think he should care about? 2-1. 2-1. Those third graders put down good food. Agriculture in this state and in this country. We will lose 1,000 small farmers this year. Something's not right. The second thing they wrote, education, a good education. Granted, those third graders misspelled education, but they still knew that it was important. Without a good public education system, I certainly do not get to be here. Third, a good job. Third graders now. A good job they thought was important. In a global economy, our children face uphill battles. A good job. The fourth thing, health care. 40 million Americans without health care today. Many of them earning $30,000 a year working a couple of jobs, a quarter of them children. Mrs. O's third grade class, the fifth thing was housing. A home to live in, a safe, secure place to go to and to leave. Now, granted, they didn't think about Social Security and Medicare and prescription drugs, but when you're 50, you start thinking about that, and I'm 50. My 82-year-old dad and my 78-year-old mother should not have to worry about Social Security and Medicare. Promises government makes are promises government should keep. Bartenders listen. They know your dreams. They know your problems. They know what you want for your children. I'm the closest thing to you in this race. And unless we believe we can accomplish miracles, we don't try. I believe I can make a difference, and I believe I need your help to do that. Thank you for having me here, and I'm looking forward to the next 45 minutes.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Jerry Janicich. Finally, Mike Cerisi, good morning.
Good morning, Alan. Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Can't hear you.
Good morning.
All right. Thank you. Who am I and why am I running? We've been, all of us, all over the state, and each of us have heard each other's background probably 30 times. You haven't, so I'm going to give you a brief background of who I am. My father was a son of an immigrant. He had a seventh grade education. My mother died when I was in the seventh grade of breast cancer. I had great teachers when I was young. I then worked my way through college and law school. And when I left law school, I went to work for a law firm that was started by two Jewish lawyers here in Minneapolis because they couldn't get a job at the top law firms, even though they graduated at the top of their class from law school. And they started a firm, and that firm has been dedicated to one principle over 62 years, and that is that everybody is entitled to a level playing field. And for 29 years, I have served that firm and our clients and have been dedicated to that principle. I have believed that people who have a common belief in a cause can move mountains. And many times over the course of that 29 years, together we have moved mountains on behalf of people. We've represented individuals, we've represented unions, and yes, we've represented companies who have employed thousands of Minnesotans. I'm running this year because I believe, as Mark said, it is a critical year in this nation's history. And the overriding issue, folks, that every other issue is subsumed in, is self-interest versus the common good. The Republican prescription is self-interest. Give me back my money. You've heard Bush say it on TV. You've heard the Republican politicians who follow his prescription say it. I believe that there are certain things in this country that we do better together. And the thing we do best at is we invest and commit to each other. And that is what will win this election, and that is the issue that will override this election. Whether we can articulate to our fellow citizens in a time of great prosperity that we owe investment in each other and commitment to each other. And the first place we start, in my judgment, is taking a look at the projected surplus and what are we going to do with it. And I'm talking about the non-Social Security surplus. And the first thing we ought to do is dedicate it to education, because education is the key to moving up the economic ladder. And whether it is the Higher Ground Academy that started by Bill Wilson over in St. Paul last fall, or whether it's the Abraham Lincoln Alternative School, or whether it's the public school systems, or whether it's higher education, we need to rededicate ourselves to education and to make sure children, our mirror to the past and our hope for the future, have a good education. Health care, we need to address health care in this country. Rural revitalization, which is not just the farms, but it's getting the rural areas over the digital divide. It's rebuilding the small towns. It's making sure that they have a sound educational system. And yes, there should be a tax cut. And the type of tax cut that there should be is starting to pay down the national debt so that our children are not burdened with a debt that was quadrupled during the Reagan years. And that paying down the debt, we know, will provide less expensive capital, which will enable people to get cheaper home loans, cheaper car loans, cheaper credit card loans, cheaper student loans. That is a true tax cut for working men and women in this country. So I believe that if we join together and commit to each other and invest in each other, that all of us will be able to move up the economic ladder. And I know what that's like because, much like Mark, I wasn't born to wealth. I didn't come from wealth. Some people at this table did. But I knew because of what my father told me, who worked Monday through Friday, 8 to 8 every day and 8 to 10 on Saturdays. He told me if you work hard, you're going to have an opportunity in this country. We need to make that dream available to everyone in this country. We have 11.4% children in this state living in poverty, but 25% among the African-American community. Think of that. That's what we need to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike Cerisi. We're going to take a break for a station ID.
You're listening to a live broadcast of the Inside KMOJ Public Policy Forum at Lucille's Kitchen on the heart and soul of the city's KMOJ 89.9 FM, Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Huh? Thank you, Lucille. You've heard initial presentations of Mike Cerisi, of Jerry Janicich, Mark Dayton, Steve Kelly, David Littlehog, and Steve Miles. And now we have questions coming from a panel and from the audience. I'm going to ask, first of all, Reverend Randy Staddon, who is the convener of the Black Church Coalition, to lead with the questioning. And if there are people in the audience with questions, please come to the microphone at the side. I'll recognize you and ask you to identify yourself. I'll ask you to be brief with your question, your comment. If I cut you off, please respect that. We'll begin with Reverend Staddon. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I wanted to welcome you here I also wanted to say that I'm looking at a copy of the NAACP midterm legislative report card of the 106th Congress, and I see that in the 105th Congress, Senator Graham got 10 out of a possible 100, and the 106th Congress, Senator Graham got 17 out of 100. So I would say to this group that he's a disgrace to what it is that we stand for as far as an agenda is concerned, and I think the people need to know that. My question initially, you do have an agenda before you of 11 points of which we are going to be evaluating you on before you're elected and after you're elected. My first point, I think, goes to the cause of what I consider to be the problem. If, for example, we can deal with this question, we may be able to address questions of crime and homelessness and education and so forth. My question is that on January the 5th, 1993, Congressman John Conyers, a black Democrat from Detroit, introduced a bill into Congress that acknowledged the fundamental injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of slavery in the United States and the 13 colonies between 1619 and 1865. In this bill, he looked at the impact of slavery. He looked at that 75 cents out of every dollar that built this country was built upon slavery. It was disheartening that of 435 members of Congress, only 28 co-sponsored the legislation, 18 of which were black. The bill was referred to the Committee on Judiciary and also the Committee on Constitutional Rights. It has never made it out of that committee. My question to you is, number one, have you read the book called The Debt by Randall Robinson? Number two, would you support legislation calling for establishment of a commission to study the effects of slavery that Representative Conyers has introduced in the Congress?
Thank you. Let me start with Steve Miles, and we'll come down the entire panel. Say your name and your response, please. These responses should be about a minute and a half.
First off, I'd like to thank Reverend Stanton for putting that on the table, because I think that racism and the slavery that was part of it is the fundamental wound in American society. Mr. Lincoln, in his second inaugural address, said in the terrible devastation of the Civil War that for all the horror of that war, it could never redeem the horrors of slavery. Frederick Douglass congratulated him on that, and we have never, ever made good on Mr. Lincoln's assessment of the impact of slavery on our history. I strongly support a national museum comparable in scale, scope, and scholarship to the Holocaust Museum to address the issue of slavery on American history. I have not read The Debt. However, my favorite books on this topic are the complete biography or the complete speeches of Abe Lincoln, the complete writings of Frederick Douglass, and the magnificent first volume, and I'm eagerly awaiting the second volume, History of the founder of the NAACP, which we expect to have the second volume out shortly, Dr. Du Bois.
Thank you, Steve Miles. Next, Steve Kelly. I'm going to ask our timekeeper again, after the first minute, hold the sign up, and so that we have these responses down to 2 minutes each. Yes, sir.
Thanks very much. This is Steve Kelly. I have not read The Debt. I do support examination of our past to make sure that we acknowledge the effects of slavery that existed in this country. I think it is important, though, having acknowledged our past, having recognized the impacts today, that a U.S. senator provide leadership on the challenge of changing the results today of those effects from the past, of making sure that every citizen in this country, every American, has the kind of hope and opportunity that ought to be the identifying characteristic of the United States, regardless of our past, and that we need the kind of leadership that is going to focus on making sure that through employment, through health care, through education, every citizen, regardless of color, regardless of national origin, has that opportunity.
Thank you.
Reverend, I haven't read the debt.
David Littlehug.
I want to compliment Dr. Miles on bringing up the issue of a national museum regarding slavery. It should be on the Mall in Washington. And I can still remember at a gut level going through the Holocaust Museum for the first time. And until you're inside the railroad car, until you've seen the piles of shoes of Jews who were killed in the Holocaust, you can understand intellectually the nature of the Holocaust, but not viscerally, and we need the same thing with regards to slavery. There is no question that the emblems and the badges and the consequences of slavery are still with us. I was just appalled at the lack of debate within the Republican primary during the South Carolina primary, this Republican Party during the South Carolina primary, about the Confederate flag, and how there are people in this country that are apparently still willing to go right to the wall for that badge and that emblem of slavery. And finally, John McCain, after the fact, said, I was wrong. But of course, the compromise, they take the flag off the Capitol and they put it in a prominent place of honor on the Capitol grounds. An emblem and a badge of slavery. And yes, we need to continue research and bringing issues to light, but we know what the consequences of slavery are, and now the burden is on us as yet another generation to deal with the issues of living wage and affordable housing and public education and medical care that have been left over and affect people in this room and people throughout this country every day.
Thank you, David Littlehug. Mark Dayton.
Reverend Stadden, I have not read the book. I've read a lot else. I would support the commission as you described it, overcoming my personal bias against establishing any more commissions by government, but in this case I think the subject overrides that concern, the effects of slavery, and I would like to charge that commission also with taking that historical atrocity and applying it to the racial divides in America today, and I think that topic ought to be addressed by a commission of the United States Senate, the United States Congress. Why is it in this country that race condemns people? Why is it that race condemns children to poverty, to dead-end, low-wage jobs, to poor nutrition, lack of health care, to substandard educations? My first job out of college, I taught in a public school in the Lower East Side of New York City, and the first summer, as part of the training program, I lived with a welfare family in a public housing project there. That's where I really understood how unfair it is that I, just through the luck of birth, was born into so much, and those children and the children I taught for 2 years in ninth grade, although they taught me a lot more than I taught them, why it is that they, through the fate of birth, were born into such totally different circumstances and lack of opportunities. And that gulf is one that anybody in this country should be aware of and should be living the solution to.
Thank you. Jerry Janicich.
I have not read the book. I would support the commission, and I will get the book. Okay. What I have read, though, is Life's Little Instruction Book by H. Jackson Brown, and I don't know how many of you have read that one. But I have it usually, well, mostly I keep it in the bathroom. And what it is, it's about a young man who's going off to school, and his dad sits down and writes down reasons, little things that he thinks are important for him to advance in life. And what it is all about common sense and treating people fairly. And where I live and where I was born and raised, it was about nationalities. And we got through that. And you would think that in our country today, we would have already gone through all of this. And it's not like we have to reinvent the wheel. It's all about common sense and treating people fairly.
Mike Cerisi, thank you.
Thank you. I have not read the book. I've heard of the book. I believe it deals with reparations, and that's part of the commission. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the question.
That's the question.
And that has not yet been answered. So I will directly answer that. Okay? I am not in favor. Thank you. You may not like my answer. I'm in favor of a commission that examines slavery. And I'm going to tell a story about my own background. I'm not in favor of reparations. I'll directly tell you that, because I know that's what you were asking. When I was young and growing up, my dad spoke with broken English. And once in a while, as a result, some kids might make fun of him. I got in a few fights. And when I was young, somebody gave me a book, and that book was Black Like Me. I don't know how many remember that. But it had a profound impact on me. What I believe in terms of reparations are what I talked about in my opening statement, and that is that each and every child in this country have an opportunity, a real, true opportunity, to achieve her or his maximum potential. Will they all make it? No. But do we as a society have an absolute obligation to make sure that's available to every child, regardless of race, color, or creed? Yes. That is what I am in favor of, and that's what I want to work for, and that's what I've done for 29 years, is create level playing fields, and I commit to do that in the United States Senate.
Thank you. Question from the audience, Mahmoud Okabi.
Oh, yeah, I didn't get it. I want to thank Reverend Stanton for raising this question, and I want to make it crystal clear that I'm neither a Democrat or a Republican. As far as I can tell, I have no intention of being one. I learned in this democracy you should be allowed to do that. I frankly think the political parties are obsolete. You don't know it yet. You go in the way of the dodo bird. I want to say this, and I appreciate your honesty, if that's indeed honesty. That's been tried before. We talk these platitudes about individuals making it and so forth in a level playing field. That is not what the question is about. The question is about people being robbed fundamentally of their humanity for 10 generations, and nobody knows anything about that. Nobody knows anything about that. You know about the suffering of people all over the world. I admit, and I empathize with Jewish people. One of the differences between Jewish people and black people's suffering is that Jewish people's suffering is a part of the moral history of the world. It's part of moral history. Ours is not even that, and we don't have a history. It's blasted, it's disrespected every day. Listen, this is a bottom line question. This is the last mile. Fasten your seatbelts. Get ready for a rough ride. This is going to be the most explosive thing since black power, once the black community is informed. We don't tell black, just white people to read this. Every black person should read it and learn to think for yourself, because that is the question. It has been raised before by A. Philip Randolph, ignored. He called it domestic Marshall Plan. Martin Luther King, with his dying breath, talked about a redistribution of wealth. He tried to start a poor people's campaign to do what you're talking about, bringing all the poor together, one economic class, ignored. This is the last chance for you. And why I feel like I do, I think the greatest Democrat that ever lived, who was incidentally not a Democrat, was Frederick Douglass, a Republican. And he concluded that American leaders, as far as black people are concerned, they do wrong from choice and right only from necessity. That's still true today. So I'm saying, gentlemen, try to find some moral sensibility somewhere in your life, because this is what the problem is all about.
Let me ask each, thank you, Mahmoud Elkadi. Let me ask each candidate to come back to the question, and the question is important enough for us to have you understand the gravity and the seriousness that we attach to the question of slavery, the repercussions and the aftermath of slavery and where we go forward. So I'm going to ask you to come through one more time and respond to both the initial question raised by Reverend Stadden and the comments raised by Mahmoud. Where do you stand on how do we repair America, because the hurt is a hurt around the imprisonment, the enslavement of 10 generations of people?
Well,
can I just have one little follow-up for you to think about as you have said that, too? I'm concerned that that Mr. Cerisi had, for example, said that he was not in favor of reparation, and yet what we did with the tobacco settlement that gave him great wealth was that we provided reparation for people who had been injured as a result of smoke. So we might consider that when we as we deal with questions.
Well, this is Dr. Miles speaking. I'd like to thank Mahmoud for pushing the issue further, because that is the issue. And I'm glad that he's not a Democrat or Republican, because I think the Democrats have taken the black vote for granted. So I'll tell you my own background. 20 years in the county hospital means that I have held the victims of your community from gunshot wounds. I've seen what drugs have done on the street. I've taken care of the victims of sex crimes and the sex industry. I've seen the people in the African-American community, like a roofer, who's lost a hand because of a lack of health insurance, and I've seen many members of the black community go on dialysis from untreated high blood pressure. It's a day-to-day intimate contact with the community, and it's taught me a lot. Now, on the issue of reparations is a very complex question. I will read the book. There is affirmative action, and I am shocked at the conservatives who say, well, we can stand on the great leap forward of our Constitution, but they refuse to adjust the great leap backward of slavery. I think that they have tried to take apart the hand up, which would heal the wound of racism. They have failed to suppress and punish discrimination and hate crimes. We have the stain of capital punishment in the United States. We are the only developed country does it, and Mr. Lilahog speaks of bullet drills. What would the white community do if 3 out of 4 DNA tests showed that white people had been wrongly convicted instead of black people had been wrongly convicted? And I stand against capital punishment. And furthermore, we need the museum to close the wounds. But I think that affirmative action is part of the construct of reparations. And I look forward to ongoing discussion, because we simply have to close this wound in our society. And it is, as Dr. Du Bois said, the deepest original sin of the American Republic.
Thank you. Next, Steve Kelly.
I'll acknowledge a difficulty answering this, because I'm white and I don't know what it feels like. But I will say, I haven't read the book, and so I don't know when you say reparations what you mean by reparations. I will say that too. But I will, in response to the comments that were made, you know, I represent a district that is a first-ring suburb district. We don't have as much in the way of people of color as there are in Minneapolis. Our schools have more whites than there are in Minneapolis. But I am proud to represent a community that doesn't have to, but did participate in voluntary settlements with the NAACP, State of Minnesota, and the Minneapolis School District to try to ensure that kids have an opportunity for a good education in schools that are not segregated. I don't know how best we deal with the problem of reparations, but one way has to be to give our kids hope for a better future. Another way we have to do it is by making sure that they have a decent place to live. And I'm proud of my communities, because we do have affordable housing for people of all races. Now, those are the things, and I recognize, and I can hear in this group that those answers are not enough. But those are the answers that we can actually take action on going forward. There are actions that I know the Council of Churches is concerned about because they were in the points that were sent to us. How do we make sure that people can make choices about where to live in this whole metropolitan community, not just in Minneapolis? And how do we make sure that people of whatever means can afford and be accepted in communities throughout this metro area? That's what I will fight for as a U.S. Senator.
Thank you. David Littlehog.
Well, maybe I'm off base here, Reverend, but it seems to me these two questions have to do with, can these white guys up here get it? Is that, that's what we're getting at, right? Can you get it? Well, I second what Steve Kelly says. A white guy growing up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, I haven't felt it directly. But Reverend Jerry McAfee, I think he thinks I am being educated and can be educated. Reverend Stanton, you and I have had a dialogue for a long time, and I hope you see some hope for education here. Others in this room, we've had that dialogue. Now let me answer your question directly. Should there be compensation? Yes, there should be compensation. What kind of compensation? Well, first of all, this all goes to power. This all goes to power. White slave owners had the power over African slaves and exploited for economic advantage. There needs to be a continual movement of power. And that has to do, first of all, with people organizing. All the studies indicate that unions disproportionately benefit people of color. Need in power, there is collective strength. In collective strength, there is power. And we need labor law and reform in this country to make sure that people can organize, associate, communicate, bargain, and if necessary, strike. But second, there need to be African-American people in positions of power. When I came in the U.S. Attorney's Office, there were 40 assistant U.S. attorneys. One was African-American. When I left, more than 20% were people of color. And my successor, who I recommended to Paul Wellstone and President Clinton and Janet Reno, is an African-American man. When you walk in that office and you go in the big conference room, since Minnesota was a territory, you see white faces, U.S. attorney after U.S. attorney. And I am the last one in that row. And it's because this is a white male who reached out and understands that there needs to be a movement of power. Now, you don't see this sitting up here at this table, but I will keep working for that.
Thank you, David Littlehog. Mark Deaton.
Go ahead. I'm not gonna pander. I'm for the commission to define the scope of the atrocity. I'm opposed to reparations because I don't think it's going to happen politically, and I think it diverts valuable time and like today and attention away from what we need to do.
Go ahead, keep going.
I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I come from the AA tradition, which says you make amends. Amends means you can't undo the horrors of the past. It means you have an obligation in terms of what you do now and in the future to address that horror. I get that what's wrong today is wrong today, and that the attention and the resources of this country ought to be mobilized to address those problems. We ought to have more money going into public education. The big lie is that we're spending too much, we're not spending enough. You talk about a domestic Marshall Plan. That's what this country should have, because the racial divides and the racism and the polarization and the discrimination of today is what's damaging African American kids, adults, destroying families, other families of color. That's where the focus should be. Are the wrongs of the past horrors? You bet. Should we feel ashamed of them? You bet. You want to spend the rest of our lives trying to quantify that and not having it result in anything?
I don't think that's a good strategy. I'd rather take all of that evidence of the atrocities and the scope and say, let's do something now going forward to make amends and to make a difference. And because we owe every one of those children and families that opportunity, those resources, that health care, the like, let's make that the multi-billion dollar, if you want to call it reparations, I'd say the multi-million billion dollar Marshall Plan that can address these real problems that the black church leaders have described here.
Thank you,
Ms. Bulletin.
Thank you, Mark Dayton. Next, Jerry Janisich. We're down to about 5 minutes, so we're going to have two more comments, your comment and Mike Cerisi's, and I might have you guys take about 30 seconds for a parting shot, but that's about where we're going to end today. So,
I'm Jerry Janisich, born in Chisholm, Minnesota. I'm Slovenian. We had nationalities. Do I support the commission? Yes. Will I read the book? Yes. Could I possibly know how you feel? No. I would not be being honest with you. But can I do the things that I've been doing in the legislature to help? Yes. Can I fight to help in the Synergy Academy to help make some of that work? Yes. Can I fight on the Education Committee to make sure that we have money for our schools? Yes. Can I make sure that we have breakfast for our children when they get there? Yes. I mean, all of those things I think are part of how we get there as a community. I don't know how I can go back and right the wrongs. I can't get there. But I can help take a look at where we want the future to be. And that's what I would do.
Thank you, Jerry Janisich. Mike Cerisi, your last and this second take on the question of reparations.
Thank you. And I guess I did understand the question the first time through. You said it's the last chance for you. Okay. All right. Good. Because it's the last chance for us, is the way I look at it. It does mean this country, and it means all of us in this country, each and every one. Well, I disagree with you. So we can agree to disagree. I think it's us. Okay? Okay? That is good. It does sharpen it. The book, as I understand it, says money compensation in reparations. Doesn't it? Isn't that what it says? What is it? Hold on, I said I didn't read it. Then tell us, define reparations. Define reparations. So we can at least debate this issue on the merits.
You know what? We're going to be out of time, so we can't do that.
Right.
But why don't you summarize your idea?
All right, then how do you repair for damages? Isn't one... just a minute. Okay, all right, so that's what you're talking about, talking compensation.
Can I have your attention, please?
Let me finish
up here. Please go ahead, Mike Cerisi.
Thank you very much. There was somebody over here, a gentleman, raised the issue of the tobacco case. Okay? And they said that was reparations. It wasn't reparations. Well, okay, well, I guess we're going to argue, again, what the term reparations is. That was compensation based on certain conduct. Now, for 40 years, that's right, we're going in the right direction, right?
Mike Cerisi, you've got to make your point and not talk to the audience.
Right.
Okay, so make the point, make your statement, and let's close it up.
I think you put all of us at a bit of a disadvantage to say, just a minute, hold on, and that's fine, you can clap about that. All right, bit of a disadvantage if we can't engage the audience in this debate.
Okay.
And maybe this forum doesn't allow that. But we are at a disadvantage in that. And I'll stay here. And I'll stay here and debate with you after we're off the air, okay? And I'll stay as long as you want me to. All right? I believe that what we need to do is what I said, and that is give everybody in this country an opportunity to succeed. And that is compensation.
Mike Cerisi, thank you. Let me wrap this up now. I want to thank all of you for being here, for listening. As you can tell, if you're listening at home, this is a heated conversation.